Robinson speaking. Our second speaker is Michael Izzard from Microsoft Research. When he is not spending his time doing computer vision research, he occasionally bops over to the system side of things and invents systems like Dryad. And today he will tell us about new mechanisms for allowing a fairly uncooperative bunch of people to fight for resources in a cluster and see how the cluster behave in the ways you might actually want it to behave.
Okay, thank you, David.
Just 1 second, sir. Please, of course.
So, yeah, I'm going to describe a joint work that we did at Microsoft Research Silicon Valley with my colleagues Vijay, John, Udi, Jamal, and Andrew. And I'm going to talk about a new scheduler that we've built for our shared Dryad cluster at the lab. So first, I want to motivate the problem that we were trying to solve, the problem that we used to have before we built this new scheduler. So as Yuan has explained, many of our users are using Dryad Link, and what they get from this is that they sit at their desktop and they write their programs, and then when they run them, the programs get distributed down to the cluster downstairs and they get to use the full cluster resources. And this generally makes the users fairly happy, and they're particularly happy when they're the exclusive user of the cluster and they get all the resources. But as the system has become more popular and we've got more users, with our previous scheduling solution, we ended up with frequently the situation where somebody would turn up in the morning and start a huge job, and then this would just kind of hog the cluster. And as the other users turn up and they queue their short jobs, they get stuck in the pipeline, users get angry, and we as cluster administrators would have to manually step in and solve the problem. So what we would really prefer is an automatic solution for this, where we'll get some kind of fair sharing of the cluster without manual intervention. So intuitively, what I mean by this is that we want the users, if they have a job that takes T seconds to run when they have exclusive access to the cluster, we'd like it to take no more than a factor of J longer if there are J jobs sharing the cluster. And so, you know, I'm talking about fair sharing here. Of course, you could put any quotas in. We don't have to give each job equal time, but, you know, for simplicity, I'm just going to describe it that way. But imagine here that you could put any quotas in there that you wanted. So the mechanism that we're going to try and adopt to get this fair sharing property is, suppose you have a cluster with n computers and j jobs running, then we're going to try and get this sharing simply by allocating the same fraction of the computers in the cluster to each of the jobs. So we're not explicitly going to share any other resources, in particular the network. And I'm going to talk a little bit about why, in our computational model, this is a reasonable assumption that if all you do is partition the number of computers assigned to the job, you might get fair sharing. And in fact, we'll see that we do get good results based on this. But for other computational models, this might not be suitable. So you may be wondering, I mean, people have been sharing clusters for a long time. You may be wondering why there's something new to invent. And so I'm going to motivate a little bit how our computational model is different from what runs, for example, on high-performance computing clusters that have been shared for a long time. So if you look at some typical HPC job, like an MPI job, typically what happens is it starts up a bunch of tasks. So I'm going to refer to a task that these rectangles on a lot of slides I call tasks. Just think of them as a process running on a computer. So in a typical MPI job, you start up a bunch of tasks, and they all communicate densely with each other. And they run for some very long period of time. And in particular, if one of them gets killed, then generally you have to kill all the rest of them, reorganize, and restart from some checkpoint. So it's quite expensive. You waste a lot of work if you kill or move anything from this running set. So as a result, when you're trying to schedule multiple jobs on a cluster, your typical strategy is fairly coarse-grain allocation. So you give some big block of computers to each of these jobs. These colored rectangles represent a job getting a set of computers. And then you leave this allocation static for quite some time. So if you imagine a plot of utilization of this cluster over time, the horizontal axis here is time, the vertical axis is number of computers assigned to a job color-coded, you'd end up with something fairly coarse-grained like this, where you just give a job a bunch of computers and let it keep them until it's done for quite a long time. And another aspect of typical HPC systems is that the data that's used by these jobs lives in a SAN off on the side. So really, the scheduling problem is one of gang scheduling. So you might be very concerned that all the tasks in a job end up on the same rack, for example, so they can communicate efficiently with each other. But you probably don't care which rack it is, because all of the data that they're loading is coming off cluster from a SAN anyway. So what you end up is frequently some kind of generalized bin packing problem. Now, the computational model that we're interested in is quite different. So this is, I'm going to describe it as Dryad, but it's, for the purpose of this talk, it's essentially the same for Hadoop or MapReduce. So here we have a job doing a data flow computation. So up at the top, there's a root task. And then there are going to be a bunch of worker tasks that get scheduled. And so they start reading from some inputs in some storage system, and then they go forwards and perform some data flow computation and eventually write some outputs. So if we just go back, I'm going to note a couple of things about this. One is that while these worker tasks are in communication with the root task, which is controlling them, they aren't actually communicating with each other. And so they stop and start independently. And in particular, if the fault tolerance model is designed such that if you kill one of these, you can restart it, and you only waste the work of that task. It doesn't affect any of the other currently running tasks. And so these are not communicating with each other, but they're reading a lot of data. And this data is either being read from some input in the file system, but also as these tasks run, they write data to their local disks, and then downstream ones will read the data the previous ones have written from a variety of places where they wrote it. So this is a very different computational model to the NPR model. And so if you look at time plots of typical Dryad jobs, you don't end up with this constant fixed utilization here. Again, the horizontal axis is time. The vertical axis is the number of tasks that are running when this job has exclusive access to a cluster. You get these kind of phases where for long periods of time, there's not much concurrency in the job. It's not using very many tasks. And so if you want to share a cluster with jobs like this, you'll want some much more fine-grained strategy of how many tasks each job gets assigned at any given time. So this fine-grained sharing model for this computation model, fine-grained sharing is a much more appropriate solution than the kind of coarse-grain that you would get in an HPC cluster typically. And so it works better if you multiplex each computer between all of the currently running jobs. So in general, when a task completes on a given computer, you will reassign that to a task from a different job, maybe. So while we want to ensure that each job gets its fair fraction of the computers at any given time, in general, the actual set of computers that it's assigned will vary quite a lot over the running time of the job. And this also allows it, if its input data has been striped across the whole cluster, this allows it to touch all the computers at some point to read it input locally from those. So I can show this graphically. So here the black rectangles each corresponds to one of the computers in our cluster, and they're grouped by racks. And then this timeline over here, the horizontal axis is time, and again the vertical axis shows color-coded the number of tasks assigned to a job. And so this is kind of in the bad old days with no fairness. And so each of these rectangles is going to get a color showing which job was running on it. This is sped up 250 times. So this big red job started up. And some other jobs have started. They've been allocated root tasks, but they don't get any workers until the red job finishes. And after that, they finally do, and they do start multiplexing the cluster. But by this time, you end up with lots of idle machines because they're all blocked behind this red job. And so what we would prefer is this really fine-grained multiplexing so that when there are lots of jobs available to run, they're really sharing the cluster and multiplexing very aggressively. But then the red job, as soon as there's less work from the other jobs present, the red job gets assigned more computers. And so its number of computers goes up and down a lot as there's more available for it. So finally, I just want to say a bit more about the data locality. So typically, our cluster, we have disks on every cluster. We don't have a SAN. And so, as I said, each task is going to be reading inputs from one or more computers in the cluster, and each task in general is reading its inputs from different places. So, from that data flow graph, you could see it's common for a task to want to read input from multiple upstream nodes, so we have to be able to do remote reads. And so, in general, you can run one of these tasks on any computer in the cluster that you want, but if it's far from its data, then you'll incur a larger remote read cost. So if one of these data sets is very large, you would much prefer to locate the task on the computer where its input is. So now we have this fair sharing problem. We want to give each job its fair fraction of the computers, but we also want to do this obeying some locality constraints. And now this is starting to look like it might start to get complicated constraints to satisfy both the locality and the fairness, because you can imagine that there might be some computer that has data that all of the jobs want, and you just can't have all of them with their best locality decision and still get fairness. So we're going to have some kind of trade-off. So now I'm going to switch gear and talk about how you might try and solve this problem. And I'm going to start off describing a strawman solution. This is the design that the Dryad scheduler used to have. It's what the Hadoop scheduler does now. Unfortunately, we have no public information about what Google's MapReduce scheduler does. But for the tutorial example, I'm going to imagine you have a very small cluster. You just have two racks. Each rack has three computers in it, and each rack has a local switch. So the network topology looks like this. The computers are connected to their rack switch. The rack switches are connected to the core switch. So a very natural way to think of designing a scheduler for this is with a bunch of queues. So you put one queue attached to each computer, and then you have one queue for each local rack, and then you have one shared queue for the whole cluster. So as jobs start up, their root tasks get assigned to some computers. So the green rectangles are from one job, and the purple rectangles are from another job. And as time goes by, you're going to get a bunch of workers scheduled in these queues. And the way that happens is, suppose a new worker from the green job turns up, and it has a lot of input data on computer 4, and would really like to run there. We're going to schedule it, we're going to put it in the queue for computer 4, but we also put it in the queue for its local rack, because that's somewhere it would be okay for it to run, although it would prefer this computer. And we finally put it here as well. We put everything in this shared queue. So now when a worker finishes on this computer, we take the first thing that's waiting in its local queue, and we run that, because everything in its local queue has good data locality for there, it wants to run there. Now suppose a worker finishes on a computer where there's nothing in the local queue, then we just end up taking the next best thing from the rack. And this continues like that. And finally, if a worker finishes on a computer where there's nothing in the local queue or the rack queue, we just take the next best thing from the shared queue. And we delete all the other copies every time we do that. So this type of strategy actually works pretty well for data locality. You always pick something that wants to run locally if it's available, and if not, you kind of pick the next best choice. However, it doesn't do anything for fairness. And in particular, you get that picture I showed you at the beginning, where somebody comes in the morning with their red job, and the red job has a ton of workers that want to run. It just floods all the queues, and nothing else gets to run any workers until all of those red workers have drained out of the queues. So suppose you want to add fairness to a system like this, what are you going to do? Well, one natural thing you might do is put quotas on the number of workers that any job gets to run at any given time. So let's assume here we're going to say each of these jobs gets two workers. So now when this guy finishes on computer 4, what are we going to do? Well, there's actually a purple task that would love to run there, but unfortunately purple has its quota full. We have to run a green task. So what we do is we go off and find the next best green task on the rack queue, and we run that. Now, 5 seconds later, imagine this worker finishes. Well, now again, there's green stuff that wanted to run there. Actually, green 5 wanted to run there, but it's too late. We put green 5 over here. So we have to go get the next best purple task, and we do that. And now, these two have ended up running in exactly the wrong place. And if we go back in time a moment, at this point, what we really would have preferred to do is to say, well, we only just started 5. Fault tolerance model says it's fine to kill these things and restart them. So let's just move it. Let's just move 5 over here and run 3, and now they're both running where they wanted to run. And you can design heuristics to try and do this in this queue-based model. For example, you can wait a bit in case something better comes along. But I think this kind of exposes the limitation of this whole design, which is that you're locally making decisions based on looking at a subset of the queues when computers become free. And really what you would rather do is to take a global view so you can look across all the tasks waiting in the system, and you can do things like moving tasks to more suitable locations when the state of the entire system changes. And so that's what our new design is intended to do. So the main insight that we have for this new scheduler framework is that we can look at scheduling with this computational model as a matching problem. So in this way of looking at things, each task is either scheduled to computer C, so it's matched to that computer, or it's not scheduled anywhere, and you can think of that as being matched to some unscheduled state. And the nice thing is, you can assign a cost to any one of these matchings. So this cost has terms for data locality. So there's some cost if you run a particular task on a particular computer, it's going to read some amount of data remotely, and you can assign a cost to that. And also, if a task has already been running for some time on some other computer and you want to move it to this one, then you can assign some cost to the work that you would waste by killing it and moving it. And as long as you can get those two types of costs into the same units, then you can construct a global cost for any matching at any time. You know, you can recompute a matching, you'll move some tasks, it will schedule some new tasks, and there's a cost to doing that change. And in addition, we want fairness constraints, and you can look at these in the context of these matchings as corresponding to the number of tasks that get matched to this unscheduled state. So the number of tasks that are matched to the unscheduled state obviously controls the number of tasks that are running. So if you have some guarantee you want to keep on the number of tasks that are running, then you just put constraints on that matching. And so, of course, the goal is going to be to minimize the global matching cost while obeying these fairness constraints. And it turns out if you draw the right network flow, you can solve this exactly using a standard min-plus flow algorithm. And so now I'm just going to go through quickly what that network looks like. So this is a flow network. Over here on the right is a sink node, and flow is going to flow along these directed edges and end up at the sink. So suppose there's some job running, and it has a root task and a bunch of workers that want to be matched, scheduled somewhere. So we're going to get one unit of flow entering at each of these tasks. And this unit of flow is going to have to get to the sink somehow. So first of all, for this job, we'll insert an unscheduled node. This is going to correspond to having an unmatched task. And we'll run an edge from each of these tasks to the unscheduled node, each of the workers. And these edges are red because they have weights on them. So we're going to put a cost on these, a fairly high cost on each of these edges. So there's a route for this unit of flow to the sink going through this unscheduled node, but it has a fairly high cost because we'd rather not do that if we can help it. So now if these workers have computers they'd really like to run because they have local data, we'll run an edge from a worker to the computer where it would like to run, and we'll put costs on those edges, and those are fairly small costs because by construction they want to run there, they're not going to have to transfer much data across the network, that would be a good place to run. Now, if there's a rack where this task has a lot of data, we can also run an edge there, and there'll be a cost on there, and that's a conservative cost. That's if we pick the worst computer on this rack, how much data transfer would we have? And so these costs are higher than the previous costs. And again, we can run everything to this global cluster node, and then we put an even higher cost, which is the worst case. If you pick the worst computer in the cluster and run it, what's that cost going to be? And finally, let's assume that this was already running on computer 5, we just put one route from the root task to the sink through this computer, and that forces the algorithm to always send the flow there, so it's not going to preempt the root task, because doing that would kill the whole job. So now we've got all of these edges, we're going to add some constraints to the graph, so we can put a constraint on each of these edges that only one unit of flow can go down here, and that means only one task can be assigned to each computer. So now there's 7 workers and only 6 computers, so something is going to have to get left unscheduled. So now we run the global optimization algorithm, and it picks the best solution. And so this guy is the guy that gets unscheduled, and that's a globally optimal way of doing that according to our costs. That does the best job of running things close to their data. Now there's one other thing I want to say about the weight. Remember there was this weight from this task that's running on this computer. As time goes on, this weight is going to decrease. And decreasing this weight is equivalent to raising the cost of any other scheduling decision. So it's raising the cost of moving that or making it unscheduled. And so having that cost decrease means that as time goes on, it gets more and more expensive to kill and move this. And that corresponds to this wasted work cost I talked about. Okay, so now some other job turns up. It has its flow that it wants to get to the sink. It has its weighted edges and unscheduled node. Now we want to get fairness between these two jobs. We'll add some more capacities on these edges. And so each of these is supposed to get 2 workers. This has 4 workers, so we'll put a capacity 2 on here, which says at most 2 of these can be unscheduled. It's going to have to put 2 of them 3 computers. Again, we'll put a capacity of 4 on here, so at least 2 of these are going to have to go somewhere. So now when we rerun the optimization algorithm, in order to find a feasible flow that obeys these, it's going to have to unschedule a bunch of the green ones. So it does that, and it computes the new global optimum based on these constraints that it has to schedule at least 2 of these workers. But Notice this is taking into account all of the data parity issues in the whole cluster and also the running times of these jobs, of these tasks that have already been running. So that's the basic design. The actual Quincy scheduler that we built has specific graph and specific design for the weights that are described in full in the appendix of the paper. So I'm not going to go into any more detail about that, but in case you're curious, the name of the scheduler is an homage to Quincy Jones, the master of orchestration. So now I'll just briefly talk about our experimental workload, results. Again, there's a lot more results in the paper. I'm going to kind of cherry pick ones that make us look good, but there are lots of results in the paper, so feel free to go and look at the details of it. So we have 30 jobs in our workload that are taken from typical dry jobs that people run. There's a mix of CPU bound and network bound. And we're running on the same cluster that Yuan talked about. It's 240 computers grouped into 8 racks of around 30 each. And one experiment consists of running the entire workload end to end and measuring a bunch of statistics with a particular scheduler design. So we run this over and over with lots of different schedulers and compare various metrics. And each of these experiments takes about an hour of wall clock time. So, you know, it's a fairly large workload. It's not just a micro benchmark. So, first of all, I'm going to show you what the ideal running times of all of these 30 jobs are. So this is the average running time of each of these jobs if you run it exclusively on a cluster with nothing else running. And so the vertical axis is time in seconds, and notice it's on a log scale. So there's a bunch of pretty short ones, and this is actually common. Users, especially when they're debugging, they often run very short jobs. And there's a few much longer ones. And they're grouped here into CPU-bound and network-bound jobs. So now, in our experiments, instead of running with the cluster exclusively, we run with a concurrency of 10. So there are 10 jobs running at a time. And remember that our goal was that each of these jobs should get no more than the factor of 10 slowdown. And because it's a log scale, that looks like a constant offset for each of these. And now I've also grouped these into fit and overflow. So remember, we have a 240 computer cluster, concurrency 10. So each of these jobs is supposed to get at least 24 computers. And so the ones that are marked fit are ones that never have a parallelism of more than 24 tasks. So in principle, these should not slow down at all if things are working well. These should be able to run at full speed. These overflow ones can use more than 24 tasks at a time, so you would expect some slowdown on those. So now what happens if you run a scheduler with no fairness guarantees? This is the picture that we saw at the beginning, where some big job hogged it, and these little jobs that should have taken 15 seconds are now taking 20 minutes, because basically they get stuck in queues. And this is what makes users very unhappy. This is what makes them come to our offices and complain. So now suppose that you add some fairness to the queue-based design, you get a much better picture. So there's still some slowdown over here. But basically everything is within the target, and this kind of looks okay. If you run with our Quincy scheduler, things look even better. So notice that most of these ones that fit have a very low slowdown, and the overflow ones have a fairly even slowdown. So I'll go back and forth a couple of times between those two so you can see. So in the fit section, Quincy's doing a much better job. But also notice over in the network bound section, the queue-based one, the network bound ones are taking a lot longer. Quincy is doing a lot better for the network-bound jobs. And that's because it's doing a good job with locality. And so now let's look and experiment with the network as the bottleneck. This is the total running time of the whole workload, and we're getting about 30% better with Quincy than we do with the Cubase one. And the reason for that, you can see by looking at what data transfer actually happens. So this is that both experiments are reading about the same amount of data across the length of the experiment, but Quincy is sending almost none of that through the core switch. And the Cubase one is making poor locality choices, and that's causing a lot of data to go across the core switch, since that's the bottleneck, is leading to this big slowdown. So as I say, there's a lot more detailed results in the paper you can look at. But in conclusion, the fact that we have this new computational model for shared clusters is an opportunity to have a new way of scheduling. And what we found is that this min-cost flow framework is an incredibly good match to this kind of dry MapReduce Hadoop computational model. Now, again, in the paper, there's a big section on limitations. This is not good for all models. In particular, we actually can't do game scheduling at all. Now, these computations don't want to do game scheduling, so that's fine, but you're not going to be able to run your MPI jobs well with a scheduler like this. And we also don't do multi-dimensional cost optimizations, and I can tell you why I don't think that matters for these as well. But you know, there are things that you can't do with this, but we found that it does work very well for our type of workload. And we've been using it for 7 months now on our cluster in constant use, and it's essentially stopped those complaints from users about the fairness of the cluster. We don't get bothered by that anymore. And so finally, we've had several talks in this conference going back to the old idea that a multiprocessor should be treated more like a cluster in its operating system. And I think there's maybe some hope that some ideas like this, in combination with other scheduling ideas, may lead to improved scheduling on multi-cores as well. And these ideas may move out of just data-intensive cluster computing more into the mainstream of general-purpose computing as well. So with that, thanks for your attention. I'll take questions. So we're actually doing this as purely online optimization. We're not using any estimates about runtime. We're only using, we have a cost for killing something that has already run for some period of time. We make no estimates at all about future performance. If we had good estimates about future performance, you might be able to do better, but we have not thought about how to include that yet. Now, in terms of heterogeneity, we're assuming that the cluster that you're running this job on is homogeneous. That is a good assumption for all the clusters we have within Microsoft. The data center may not be homogeneous, but the set of computers that you're running a particular job on these days typically is. Some heterogeneity you can tolerate in this framework and some you can't. In general, when you can't tolerate it, what's going on is that we don't have an efficient optimization algorithm to get the globally optimal schedule. An interesting question is, when you have something that you can't find a global optimum, would an approximation also be useful? And we don't know.
Josh Triplett, Portland State University. I was wondering, one of the big motivations to do local scheduling rather than global scheduling is specifically to be able to scale better and avoid having to look at everything at once. I'm wondering how well would the algorithms you're working with scale both to significantly larger clusters with more jobs and more nodes, as well as clusters or local systems with much shorter jobs and therefore much more rapid scheduling decisions?
So with this size of cluster, the typical time for the optimization is about 8 milliseconds, and it goes up to 50 or 60, kind of worst case that we see. So it's very manageable for the small cluster. We've run simulations on a cluster that's 10 times bigger with 10 times as many jobs, and then the optimization goes up to about a second per computation. So it may be that that's actually okay, because the nice thing about a global solution is that you kind of get everything. You only get a second latency issue. You don't get the piling up. You don't get the throughput issue. So that might be okay. Also, the common case. So we rerun the optimization every time a task enters or leaves. But actually, the common case is one task leaving, and we believe Andrew Goldberg believes that we can do an efficient incremental flow computation for those. So that may be less of an issue. But you know, the real answer is we haven't done it yet. In terms of if you have many, many more scheduling decisions to make, you may be okay just because you probably aren't going to do that on a very large cluster. For this type of workload, you probably aren't going to do that on a very large cluster. If you're doing it on your multi-core, then maybe it's not such a big network, maybe you can get away with it. But again, we haven't tried it.
So I have two questions, and they're not quite orthogonal. One, how sensitive is the approach to the cost model that you have, depending on how good they are? And we did something like this in the past where we actually used it for the 3D sketch of the residence, a global sketch of it. And we found that you have to be very careful when you move jobs, because they often tend to ping pong back and forth. And one of the risks might have with that, the result of either union coming jobs or a poor mismatch cost.
So, we haven't done a full sensitivity analysis with the cost model. The only real experiment that we've done is we have two network configurations. One of them, the core switch, is a bottleneck, and the other one, it isn't. And so we have different costs for those two. And you can make it much more aggressively shift things off the core switch if you tell it to. And it's quite good at doing that. When the network isn't much of a bottleneck, that doesn't really affect any of the running times, which is kind of to be expected, but it doesn't hurt throughput, for example. We have not seen a lot of ping-ponging, and I think the reason for that is that these costs are anchored fairly well by the large amount of data that's being read. Yeah, I don't have a really detailed explanation for why we don't see the problem. You do see it frequently, something will start and then get immediately killed because you get kind of race conditions between new jobs starting up. But that doesn't matter very much. You don't see things being moved very often. We have costs built in that explained in the paper in order to make sure that we get some... So every time you get moved, you accumulate more cost for moving you the next time. So there is a progress guarantee that may be helping us there as well.
Maybe this was a Tim Reck from the... Tim Reck from the University of Waterloo. Maybe this is addressed in the paper, but a lot of this smells a lot like some work that was done in the early 90s that was dynamic equipartitioning. And the idea was to space share processors instead of to time share them. And maybe I'm just curious to understand sort of where the differences lie here compared to that.
I'm not sure which specific work.
Just like John Zavarian, Catherine McCann, somebody else from maybe Symmetrics and probably Tox.
Okay, I don't think I've read that work, so I can't really comment.
Jen Ashton from Google. I have a question about the premise of the problem. So you're not sharing these machines with online services that are probably producing the data, say you want to go over emails and a text spam in your offline processing. So the data has to be shipped in from somewhere. So why aren't you doing a better job of spreading the data out with machines so that scheduling is less important or it's easier to schedule?
I'm not sure I understood the question. So the input data set typically is scraped across the whole cluster.
So you said that the problem is that you have large pieces of data on one machine, and therefore you need to schedule workers closely. Whereas if you have spread the data out over all the machines, and you spread your workers out over many of those machines, there's a good chance that you don't have to copy the data across racks, and likely you're able to get more on the same machine as well.
Well, okay, so suppose that you've spread it across all the machines in the cluster, and you just put, you were only allowed to have the workers on one rack. Sure, it'll read locally from that rack, and then it's going to be like, well, where am I going to get the rest of the data from? The point is that if you spread the thing over the whole machine, at some point during the running of the job, you're going to want to run a worker on each computer in the cluster so that it can read locally at that time. So it's not about having one big thing in the middle where you have one worker goes. Every single worker has infinity. And so, you know, don't think of it as being an issue of whether one worker has to read a large amount of data. Over the lifetime of the job, can you read all of its inputs locally, or do you have to shift all of its inputs across the cluster? And if you don't have locality, then every single time you do it, you know, at the beginning, maybe if you just click around the computer, there'll be something there. But after a while, unless you're able to cycle through all the machines in the cluster, that doesn't work out.
So from our experience, we've seen that copying data across racks is really the expensive part, and not local machines. So as long as you have data on the rack, you're able to support the machine.
So it may be that a Dryad is able to exploit this better as well. So imagine we're doing a page rank computation. So it's an iterative computation. And the way this is structured is at the first phase of every iteration, you're doing a join between a large piece of data that's located in just one place and the output from the previous phase. And so the way you compute the output from the previous phase is that you're doing some kind of repartitioning. And so when one of those repartitioning nodes runs, it's reading data from all over the cluster, and so it has no particular affinity. So it just gets scheduled on some random computer. Then the next guy has a strong data affinity, but the guy upstream from him was running on a random computer. So if you just, at the end of the first phase, you know, that first repartition finishes, there's only one free computer. If you're not careful, you're going to put the next guy from the next phase on that one computer that was free, whereas what you'd actually rather do is put it on the one over there where it becomes free. And so in the MapReduce case where you're having this barrier and replicating all of the data at the end of every phase, you know, maybe you're not seeing the problem as much, but you're also transferring a lot more data.
Yeah, I'm going to kick you guys to the whiteboard to finish that discussion. Let's thank our speaker again.